Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey everyone, how are we all doing today? Welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and today on the show, I sit down with the one and only Alex Garland, a writer and director whose films have had a huge impact on me, both in terms of my love for cinema and how I approach the page as a writer. Ex Machina, Annihilation, the TV series Devs, these are just a few of Alex's stories that have taken viewers to fascinating philosophical places, asking borderline unanswerable questions about who we are along the way. This week, Alex is back with another movie throbbing with unanswerable questions, the incredible Civil War. It's his most explosive film yet, and a movie tethered to our current reality in this incredibly confrontational way. You might have noticed over the last, 8 or 9 years, that we have entered an intensely politically fractious time across the globe. There is a timeliness in Civil War to Alex's tale of a group of photojournalists traveling towards Washington in a USA divided that reflects that in ways his previous films have not. And yet, this movie is no act of sensationalism chucked like a grenade into an election year already rife with division. Instead, as you'll discover in the spoiler conversation you're about to hear, it's a story about the noise of opinion and the need for neutrality and impartiality amidst that noise. The result is a war movie kind of unlike any other war movie I've ever seen, with a purposeful sense of detachment that mirrors its character's profession, and also how worn down they are by the violence of it all, a violence so numbing it hardly seems to matter anymore how all this conflict got started. Kirsten Dunst and the rest of the ensemble cast are fantastic, and there's a rhythm to the movie's action that's really interesting. It's completely gripping, which is what we've come to expect from Alex, who had plenty to say about the film, its roots in our current reality, and how he pens the instantly unforgettable imagery of his movies, from the dance sequence of Ex Machina to the shrieking bear of Annihilation, all the way to the emptied urban spaces of 28 Days Later. Thanks so much to Alex for being a fantastic guest, and thank you as ever to our Patreon supporters, without whom this show would not be possible. If you like what we do on Script Apart and you want to see the show continue to grow, you can join our Patreon community today for the price of a single cup of coffee, and in return get all sorts of fun perks, including ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and the chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests. That address one more time, in case you'd like to get involved, is patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, with that all out the way, Let's jump in. This is the wonderful Alex Garland discussing the first draft secrets of Civil War. Thanks everyone for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek with production assistance by Pav Patel. Alex, such a joy to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I wanted to begin by asking what the emotion is for you right now on the brink of Civil War's release, and whether that emotion is different at all compared to past movies, because, you know, this is a very politically charged film. It's addressing some very real post-January 6th American anxieties. What does that translate to in terms of any extra trepidation about releasing this movie compared to past releases? It's very volatile ground that you're stepping into. And I'm curious what that means for your experience at the moment of talking about the movie and getting it out there into the world.
Well, just for what it's worth, it was written before January the 6th. But maybe that's by the by, because that doesn't mean it wouldn't be charged by it, I suppose. In terms of how this one feels in comparison to other ones, in a funny way, I should know, but I don't, because one gets kind of amnesia about this process until it starts again. And then you think, oh yeah, yeah, that's right. That's what it's like. Mm-hmm. And my approach to it is something like, I think, look, the film is made, it's done. I can't change anything about it. It will do what it will do. And for a period, it usually lasts sort of 2 to 3 weeks, and I'm in that zone at the moment. I'm a cork on a stream. I don't have a lot of control, in a sense, over what happens next. That's not exactly true. I could say something, or yeah, I could make some kind of statement or do some slip of phrase that is too open to misinterpretation or something like that. So I could cause a problem, but for the most part, it's just a process which is ongoing that very abruptly spits you out at the other end and then is gone. Mm-hmm. And in this particular instance, I will go straight from the release of this back into prep of a couple of other movies that I've written, or one of them I've co-written and one of them I've written, and I'll be back to the day job. So this is a strange sort of surrealist blip that will end quite soon.
Yeah. It's a film that uses photojournalists as our route into the story, Alex. Other filmmakers might have opted to tell this same tale about a fractured country whose government is about to be overthrown. They might have told that tale through the eyes of a group of freedom fighters on the front lines of that fight. It's also easy to imagine another director telling the same overarching story by kind of bunkering us down with the soon-to-be-deposed president, like, an American version of Downfall. Why photographers here, Alex? Why are they your way into the material in Civil War?
Oh, well, in truth, because I've kind of got an agenda. I mean, I've usually got an agenda, maybe always, actually, in whatever film I write or make. And part of the agenda, not all of it, but part of it was to do with journalism and journalists. There are two photographers. There's also two writers. Yeah. in the car, in the story. It was about... The film is partly about journalism. It's partly about journalists, a form of journalists who are reporters, who don't have a bias. They are simply presenting the things they see. And in fact, at one point, they have a brief discussion about that within the film. And it's a more old-fashioned form of journalism. It's also journalism I literally grew up around. My dad was a cartoonist on a paper, and a lot of his friends were journalists, and my godfather and was a foreign correspondent, as was my younger brother's godfather, who's a different foreign correspondent. So I really grew up around these people. And I said to someone quite early on in this process, I said, yeah, no, I think I'm going to try and make a film about journalists with journalists as the heroes. And they said, oh, don't do that. Everybody hates journalists. And it really landed on me, that, because it's a bit like saying you hate doctors. We we really need journalists. We truly need them. And we specifically need journalists that can be trusted. And bias has crept back in, or not back into, I shouldn't say back. Bias has crept into journalism in a particular kind of way. And that means that not all journalists by any means, but within a lot of the really big institutions that use journalism or trade in journalism, they're extremely biased. And in a way, that means they preach to a choir. And if you're not in that choir, you don't trust that institution and or organization. And conversely, the people in the choir that, you know, they do trust what they're being told, do not trust the other ones. So you get a generalized spread of distrust of journalism, and the unbiased reporting has a smaller and smaller voice and quieter voice. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to put reporters at the center of it and to make them heroes. They could be conflicted, they could be compromised as individuals, but I wanted them to be the heroes, because in some senses it doesn't matter if a doctor is compromised or conflicted, provided the doctor is also doing good work. That was part of the agenda of the film. So that, very long answer, but that's what lay behind it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, by the way, the film is attempting to do the same thing as those journalists. So the film is in effect acting like a piece of reportage. It's on a fictional environment with real world parallels, but it is being like an unbiased reporter in the moment.
Yeah. Well, your appreciation of journalism as something requisite for a functioning democracy, and your kind of admiration, I suppose, for the profession, that makes a lot of sense to me, knowing what I know about a period in your late teens, Alex. So when you were backpacking around the world on this trip that would eventually inspire The Beach, you managed to blag a press card and attend protests in Manila and Hong Kong. And I thought about that when I was watching this movie, and when in particular I was watching the scene in the movie very early on, where the audience is kind of embedded in the front line of journalists witnessing a protest, maybe kind of like the one you experienced. Were those experiences an influence at all?
I'd steer it back towards the journalists I grew up with and around. And also that me personally, I read much more nonfiction than fiction. There's something about reporting that I find really interesting, really engaging, and just leads me to it. And I think they're often the people I respect the most. And, a lot of it is probably being a little kid. I could see how much my dad loved these people and cared about them, and then so I admired them and cared about them too and looked up to them. I'm sure that's in there somewhere. It's there are elements of lived experience in there, I guess, but really it's about thinking about journalists, what they do and how much we need it, and seeing that something very, very strange is happening at the moment, in, not surprisingly, in direct proportion to the way what gets called these days the mainstream media is increasingly distrusted, very strange fringe theories and concepts suddenly get immense amounts of traction.
Yeah.
And how instantly problematic, how instantly dangerous that is, because as we all know, all countries that are aspiring to fairness require journalism, require a free press, and you lose them either by negligence or by malign intent. You lose them at your own cost.
One of the pivotal relationships in the film, Alex, is of course between Lee, who's an established photographer, and Jesse, who's young and has aspirations of following in Lee's footsteps. What did you want to explore or tease out of Lee's character, perhaps, by having her become like a custodian or a mentor of sorts to Jesse? It kind of feels like a twist on like this storytelling template that I love that's, well, it's present in everything from Jurassic Park to The Last of Us, in which like a jaded, world-weary person is put in charge of a child or a younger person, sort of against their will, and it ultimately inspires some kind of change in them. What change did you want Jesse to inspire in Lee, and how did you come to build the film in part around their relationship?
Well, I'd just point out, in part, there are three generations. Mm. So that's just one of the staging posts in that lineup. I think it's to do with the complex state of motivations and the risk reward assessment that journalists have to make to do with their physical safety and their psychological state when they put themselves into some of the most extreme spaces that journalists get into. Mm. And a kind of be careful what you wish for approach. You don't yet know what it is you're wishing for, what you're getting in yourself into. You have a journalist in the form of Lee who is in a way at the beginning of the film in a state of some despair. And the despair reaches a kind of breaking point later on. And the despair comes from a problem that she gets characterized, gets stated at a certain point, which is, in effect, I've risked my life and I've done something which is to go to war zones and send photos home, which carry an implicit warning, don't do this, but here we are. So it was futile. That everything I've been working for has not functioned in the way it's supposed to function, and so she has lost like a sort of lapsed Catholic or something. She's lost faith at that moment in the thing she does, and then she's meeting someone who has the faith, who has that kind of youthful belief, and so it's partly to do with someone who has become either agnostic or atheist, meeting someone who is full of the sort of vigor of faith and what that confronts them with, not just about the other person, but also to do with themselves. Was that fair? I don't know.
Yeah, that rings true for me, I think. Like that's how I read it when I watched the film. There is this fascinating tension in the movie, Alex, between, I guess, what I can feel of the real world bleeding into the frame and what it feels like you're intentionally keeping at arm's length from our political reality. So the film begins with Nick Offerman's character, the president. He's reciting language that feels decidedly Trumpian. He keeps repeating this phrase, a lot of people are saying, which, you know, that's a way of framing things that Trump always falls back on whenever he's making a claim. But then suddenly, as we get further into the film, the breakdown that's happened in America in this fictional world, you establish quite quickly that breakdown has not occurred on the same fault lines as our current political reality. You know, it's not red versus blue, Democrats versus Republicans, coastal elites versus middle America, or anything recognizable. And in doing so, the film seems to announce this movie is not a what-if thought experiment wondering where the current fractures might lead the country. Can you tell me about that? Why was that important to you, that distinction?
There's different things, and I may lose track of my answer while I'm saying it, so just nudge me back onto the sort of specifics of your question.
Yeah.
So there is somewhere in my mind, now this was told to me, it's not something I've acquired firsthand, in my mind, which could be wrong, it's a Hemingway statement, but honestly, that could be way off. Could be like Ian McEwan. I've got no idea. But it's along the lines of this. If the writer understands the sequence of events in the narrative, they are able to leave gaps, because the gaps that they leave will be internally consistent, internally logical, and the reader or the viewer will be able to fill those gaps imaginatively. And I don't know if that is a Hemingway quote or not, but whether it is or isn't, I think it's true. And not only that, there is a plus to it. There's an advantage, which is, instead of being a spoon-fed narrative, it becomes a narrative which is intentionally trying to involve the participation of the viewer or reader. And now, not every story has to work like that, but some can. And the way I like to write leans to that. So that is one part of that answer. I have a sequence of events in my mind, and I think there are enough waypoints in the story, in the description, things that are asserted that allow you to make inferences if you are the kind of person who wants to make inferences. But on top of that, there is a separate side thing going on, which is to do with an agenda. Now, I've already alluded to it. It's to do with reporting. It's to do with excluding bias and making a set of assumptions about the viewer, which in a way is more conversational, you could say, imaginatively participating. That would be one way of putting it. Conversational, that would be another way of putting it. But also just kind of respecting them as sentient adults. If I were to think what my personal favorite film, the film I really loved last year, it was Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah.
And Anatomy of a Fall does not answer questions that a mainstream film would feel obliged to answer. It just doesn't do it. And it treats me like a grown-up, and I really appreciated it and really enjoyed it. I think you could also make the same case about Zone of Interest. Zone of Interest simply assumes that you have certain kinds of information available to you. That's it. And we do have that information available to us. I would say I admire both those films very much, so I'm not trying to stand alongside them. I'm talking more about a zone within the broad church of filmmaking that I loosely sit in. I think I can say with some confidence that, number one, clear political points and waypoints exist within the film. I could list them perfectly easily. I think I could also say that in terms of the reasons or the logic behind it, if I asked a viewer to speculate on those reasons, they would be able to. And we would probably agree. In other words, what are the divisions? What's the history of the divisions? Where do they come from? Where are they amplified? Where are they becoming dangerous? There would be lots of points of agreement that I feel I can rely on. And so that's what I do. And that also allows me to not be didactic. And I don't want to be didactic. Essentially, I feel that if what you want as an individual, if what you want is someone shouting their opinion at you, no problem. Guess what? You're in luck. You're going to be able to find it. There's plenty. There's tons of it out there. If that's the thing you need for yourself, your ship just came in, right? I don't feel any need to join that. I am concerned about something else. I'm concerned about the shouting. I'm concerned about the lack of communication. So I don't really want to join that. I've got no interest in doing that. I also personally perceive a difference between, and this is, by the way, this is not my insightful observation. I think this is so commonly understood that it's basically a truism, that there's a difference in behavior in the public discourse spaces of, say, social media, in comparison to how people behave one-on-one.
Yeah.
And I am trying to function on the one-on-one level, which is respectful, polite, understanding, considerate, rather than the screaming megaphone space. I could go on and actually what I think is more complex than that. It is more nuanced, but probably that sits under it.
Hey everyone, this is Al. Just jumping in with a quick word about one of our great sponsors this week. I know this is a podcast about first drafts, but guys, we have got to talk about Final Draft, the world's best-selling screenwriting software. Simply put, it's the easiest way of actualizing that exciting idea you have for a new screenplay. Final Draft 13 just dropped, and take it from me, it's by far the most customizable version of the software yet, full of easy-to-use tools so that you can get more done with your writing sessions. With industry-renowned features like the Final Draft Beatboard, Outline Editor, and Navigator function at your fingertips, you're going to find yourself charging towards your storytelling goals more efficiently than ever before. It's the first choice tool of professional screenwriters everywhere for good reason. So what are you waiting for? Kickstart your 2024 writing journey today by visiting finaldraft.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. And in terms of a first draft, Alex, I'd love to hear about what the first draft of Civil War looked like and, well, yeah, how quickly it came together, because I know that 28 days later, that script took 50 drafts for you to get right, in part because, you know, you were still learning the format of screenwriting. The pilot for Devs, meanwhile, like, it sounds like the shooting draft for that episode, that was pretty much your first draft. You nailed it on the first attempt. How did Civil War compare? Walk me through it.
Yeah, I wrote it in June of, I think, 2020. So just after the outbreak of COVID. Got sick from COVID, took a while to recover, sort of came back out into the world and started working on this. I would guess first draft, sort of ballpark 2 weeks, maybe 2.5, something like that. Then the first draft was not exactly the shooting script. I'm going to guess there are somewhere between 3 or 4 drafts, but drafts 2, 3, and 4 are related to practical considerations. So there'll be something that's written that can't quite be achieved, or a location that needs to be reframed, or it was along those lines more than, I don't know, normally what you'd be doing, say, bringing out a character or adjusting a bit of drama. You know, there'd have been a bit of that for sure, but essentially the film was the first draft. And I sometimes, there's a huge connection between writing and editing. Like editing films is essentially an extension of writing. And a rough cut of a film will essentially show you the film. It'll definitely get a lot better. But if you hate the rough cut, you're probably never going to love the film. And if you see strength in the rough cut, you're probably never going to hate the film. I mean, that's slightly too broad a statement, but roughly true.
The film is structured, Alex, around this mission to reach Washington, kind of going upriver towards the chaos, like in one of the quintessential war movies, Apocalypse Now. There are a good few films in your filmography, it strikes me, in which characters must go on a physical journey covering this huge distance. So, for example, you sent characters across the Shimmer in Annihilation. Our characters in 28 Days Later have to reach Manchester and this military outpost. The most extreme version, I suppose, is our characters in Sunshine journey to the sun. That's the longest distance. Can you talk to me about what is so inherently cinematic and full of storytelling potential about using a journey as a storytelling template? Because, it's something you do so effectively.
Thanks for the last little bit of that sentence. You know, I think maybe one of the reasons I so admired Anatomy of a Fall is that it's not using tricks like that. It's such grown-up drama. It made me feel intimidated in the best way. You know, the way you want to be intimidated, I think. Why do I do that? I think I do it because I although sometimes the stories I tell might have some complex element to them, like an idea or the way the idea is being executed or the idea behind the idea or something like that, there might be something complex. I quite like straight arrow narratives, and sure, like plot twists are great, but there's usually something quite linear going on, and it's always been like that for me. That's not really a conscious decision, it's what happens, but it does fit well with cinema. Not that cinema has to be like that, obviously Anatomy of a Fall, as I just said, but what you end up with is, in really clunky terms, something like a clear driving mission statement type thing, and then a sequence of set pieces. And the set pieces can really vary from each other. They can have a completely different tone, a completely different location. They can bring in a character who you never have to see again. And you can end up, would the right word be vignettes or something like that? You can end up with themically strung together short films or something like that. And there's a pleasure in that. There's a pleasure in being able to step outside whatever it was you just created and keep it moving and keeping it alive. Maybe it's easier as well. Possibly it's easier. I think it was easier, technically easier, to write Civil War than it was to write Anatomy of a Fall. I think that is a greater act of writing skill. And I can see that. I think that's probably why I'm intimidated by it, in a good way. Like I said, I want to be intimidated in that way. So it could also be that it's more available to structure in that form. It then causes a lot of problems in the making of it. So Ex Machina, which is closer, I would say, to something like Anatomy of a Fall, because very limited locations, very limited cast. When it comes to then shooting it, you are staying in the same space. You can really explore that space. You can explore it with a camera. You can explore it with blocking and dramatically and stuff like that. You can put a very high degree of production design into it, and a high degree in terms of thought process. If you're using the, as you said, that sort of Apocalypse Now structure that Civil War is also using, or many other films also use, you might be in a place for somewhere between one to 2 to 3 days at most. There were very few places we were anywhere more than 3 days. That means you have to relearn everything. Everything you learned from the previous space you were in no longer applies. And so in practical terms, maybe easier to write, harder to shoot.
Yeah. Well, in terms of other echoes with your past work, Alex, along the way on that journey that I just described, there are these beautifully still sequences involving empty urban spaces, the kind of spaces that we're used to seeing teeming with life in the real world. So the scene, for example, in the vacant JCPenney parking lot with that crashed helicopter, it strikes me that there's a kind of certain rhyme between that sort of scene and the empty London that you explored in the first act of 28 Days Later. I love that imagery. You know, you're someone who excels at creating imagery that really lodges itself in people's heads, finding this visual way of executing the themes and emotions of the story. I wondered if you had a process for that, or, you know, whether it occurs naturally, Alex. Talk me through it.
So number one, I think there is a conscious thought process involved in writing sometimes, and there's also something very, very unconscious. And for me, I've started to realize over the years, I have realized it's got more to do with compulsion than it does to do with decision-making. I think there's very little decision-making sometimes. So you get preoccupied by something, but did you decide to get preoccupied? No, you just became preoccupied. Even more acutely than that, I as a writer, I think many people as writers will say something similar to this. I will literally, and I mean, I'm not using this in a sort of like a metaphor, I will be doing the washing up and suddenly an entire solution to a problem or an entire storyline will occur to me in a complete form. And I've not been aware that I've been thinking about it. It's just there. And so the I part of me, how much am I, the decision-making part of me, involved in that? I don't think very much. So something else is happening, something unconscious, something to do with compulsion. So the answer to part of the question is, in a way, that's just how it turns out. I also think Dad was a cartoonist. I grew up around drawing. He taught me to draw. I use drawing a lot when I'm filmmaking to illustrate something, like loosely a frame or how something might look or something along those lines. And I also think in comic strip terms as a sequence of images. Certainly while I'm writing, I am getting a clear, very, very clear visual sense of the thing as I'm writing. Not always, but I think a lot of the time, I'm effectively watching a film very, very slowly. Instead of taking an hour and a half, it takes 2.5 weeks. But I can really see it. And I guess I could, it might be a bit of a rationalization. I might be able to associate that with my dad and with learning to draw and drawing and just, yeah, visuals. But bit of a guess.
Mm. Well, we should talk about the ending of Civil War, Alex. It's an ending very much in keeping with the rest of your films, which seem to often end on an ellipsis rather than a full stop. So with the exception of Sunshine, which does have a very definite, you know, we saved the day conclusion, your movies, like Ex Machina especially, they tend to favor endings that have this kind of scintillating ambiguity about them. In Civil War, we witness this thrilling siege on the White House. We have Lee sacrifice herself for Jesse. So we've kind of wrapped up the story from a character sense. But in terms of what happens to the broader world of this film, you know, the movie ends on the site of the president's execution through Jesse's lens. There's then nothing concrete that the film offers about what happens next. Who steps into power? What new equilibrium is achieved through everything we've just witnessed? Can you talk me through your motivations for how this ending came to be, Alex? And what you wanted it to express?
I usually start stories with the ending. I have a sense of the ending. And I think I tend to personally like endings that are quite dialogue-free. They're a sequence of images that are sustained and you can make sense of them. You can unravel them by what preceded them. So there's something wordless and something impressionistic happening. And it's like a state of resolution rather than an ending in a more traditional form, maybe, that would fit into the compulsion thing I said previously. It's just what I like. There was something, I had to get to a point where I was the director to be able to do the endings I wanted to do. That was the sort of, it may even be why I became a director, why I started directing the films. There'd be something tonal that I was looking for. And I understand there will be open-ended questions within it, which I guess is the ambiguity you're talking about. But the thing that I wanted to resolve is resolved, which doesn't have to answer all questions. I also think typically it depends what constitutes the answer to a question. I feel sometimes people say this is open-ended or this is confusing or ambiguous, and I say, no, the answer's in there. It's just not asserted in the way film grammar has led people to expect things are asserted. So Ex Machina poses a question, is this robot sentient or not? Do they have an internal life private to them or not? And then there's a shot at the end of the film where the robot looks over its shoulder and smiles, and they're on their own at that point. And that seems to me like you would never smile on your own unless you had an internal life, because it's not performative. It's not trying to trick someone into thinking you have an internal life. You are the only person in that space. So it's a demonstration of your internal life. Now, in normal film terms, that does not constitute the answer to a question, because film is a mass market media, and greater clarity is asked for when you are talking to that many people at once. But then I think, well, okay, yes, no, I understand that, but not all film is, and my films can be much smaller in their audience and their scope. And I'm perfectly content with that, because that's the grammar I like. I would say within Civil War, all sorts of statements that people think should be made might actually be being made. They're just being made in accordance with that Ex Machina type grammar, rather than the grammar that we are used to speaking. I also would not in any way want to imply that, like, I'm a special case. There are lots of filmmakers doing exactly that. I'm just one of that group. It does park you in the unpopular end of the car park. it's never going to break out beyond a certain level, I suspect, because that is not satisfying to many people, and I really, really understand that, and I appreciate it. I have no problem with it. Then my thing, I guess, is make the things at a cost level that the financier feels is justified for the difficulty and the lack of mainstream appeal of the movie, and try to get the balance right.
Mm. Well, I'll end this interview, Alex, with a glance at the future. After making Men, you sounded slightly downbeat in interviews about, like, the prospect of directing more movies. You were talking up the prospect of maybe falling back into writing more and retreating from the directorial side of things. Has the process of making Civil War done anything to change that feeling? And what does all this mean in terms of the projects you're tackling next? Is there much you can tell me about?
I've written a script for Danny Boyle to do. I have co-written a script with a guy called Ray Mendoza, and I'm going to be alongside him while he makes that film, but it's really Ray's film. I read a script the other day by an actor I've worked an awful lot with, Sonoya Mizuno, that I thought was absolutely spectacular bit of writing, and would love if I could to assist with that being made. And that's the thing that interests me at the moment. I never set out to be a director. I don't think I am a director. I think I'm a writer. If somebody would say to me, what's your job? I'd say I'm a writer. I, for various reasons, some of them just to do with life, a lot of them to do with life, but some of them also to do with work process. I wanted at that point to step back from it, and nothing's changed.
Mm. Well, if this was to be the last thing you direct, what a movie to go out on. Alex, thanks so much for coming on Script Apart. This has been so much fun. You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.